So we'll call Wimberly versus Williams. This is 2011-28, and we'll hear first from Ms. Shen.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Kathleen Shen, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Bruce Wimberly. In 1984, Mr. Wimberly was convicted of a crime with a statutory maximum sentence of 24 years. In lieu of sentencing, he was committed under the Colorado Sex Offenders Act, and he has now been serving that commitment for over 35 years. His continued confinement violates the Equal Protection Clause because the statutory maximum sentence for the offense has long since expired, but he has been deprived of the procedural protections afforded to people serving civil commitments. It also violates the Due Process Clause because there has been no finding that he is mentally ill and therefore dangerous, and because the periodic parole board review afforded is inadequate to protect the fundamental constitutional rights at stake. It's important to emphasize that Mr. Wimberly is serving only an involuntary commitment and not a criminal sentence. A criminal sentence, of course, is punishment for commission of a crime, and a person who has been convicted of a crime may be required to serve any sentence within the statutory maximum, even if he would pose no danger to society if released. By contrast, an involuntary commitment is confinement for purposes of treatment and protection of a person who is mentally ill and dangerous.
Let me probe that a little bit. You call it a commitment, opposing counsel calls it a sentence. In either event, the fact that he got one day to life was written into the statute as a consequence of a criminal conviction, which would be different than any civil committee, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I can skip ahead to the equal protection part of the argument, to respond to that. So, of course, we know this is a commitment because in Speck versus Patterson, the Supreme Court addressed a materially identical commitment under a prior version of the statute. So they said, it's a one day to life thing, and this is a commitment, and we analyze this as a commitment for purposes of equal protection and due process.
Well, I'm really not trying to get to the equal protection component. I'm just really trying to get to have a better handle on fundamentally whether it's a commitment or a sentence really matters, because at the end of the day, isn't the ultimate question whether or not Humphrey or Backstrom apply? In both of those instances, there was another procedure that would have been necessary. For example, in Backstrom, where the original adjudication was, you're going to complete this specific term, and then you will automatically eligible. You will automatically go into a different sanction, civil commitment, and then in Humphrey, the after the maximum was satisfied, then there was another an automatic renewal. Here in the original sentence was, you're going to go into one day to life. You might get out in one day, you might get out in the first parole consideration in whatever it was, 6 months, but you are going to stay there through ultimately one day to life. And that was his either your commitment, sentence, whatever you call it. And he got processed for that.
I disagree, Your Honor. And there's basically two main reasons. So in Humphrey, Humphrey involved a very similar kind of commitment, which was imposed initially in lieu of sentence. And you're right, Your Honor, that the initial commitment had a procedure for renewal at the end of the statutory maximum sentence. And Mr. Humphrey was challenging his commitment at the period of renewal. And in the course of defending the commitment, Wisconsin argued, look, we get to treat him differently because this is a commitment in lieu of sentence. He's been convicted of a crime, so he's not entitled to the same procedural protections that other people who are involuntarily committed are. And the Supreme Court said that argument might hold some weight with respect to an initial commitment, which is imposed in lieu of sentence and is limited in duration to the maximum possible sentence. Now, in this case, the fact that the initial commitment was not limited to the maximum possible sentence is the constitutional violation. Starting from scratch, That's what makes it unconstitutional.
I thought this appeal was not challenging the original sentence. This appeal was challenging the execution. And so, but you just now suggested that what you're unhappy with is the original sentence, which was potentially life served in a mental institution.
You were
very clear though. No. We're not bringing this under 2254. We're bringing it only, we're accepting the sentence. And if you accept the sentence, I agree with Judge Bacharach that the actual sentence, which included the power of being regulated by the Department of the Prisons, not any civil regulation, was that injury occurred when the sentence came down, I think, was the prison was simply faithfully executing exactly what the judge said they should do.
Your Honor, I disagree. We're challenging specifically the failure to provide an opportunity for judicial review once the statutory maximum sentence expired. And in this case,
that challenge could have been made at the time the sentence was issued. You could have said, this sentence is defective because it does not draw a different, it does not give us a new right to a hearing when the sentence that somebody else might have gotten for a fixed term had expired because the statute didn't allow anything longer than a fixed term. That challenge could have been made to the sentence itself. And so what you really are trying to do is challenge the sentence, but you did not bring a procedure allowing you to challenge the sentence itself.
Your Honor, we're challenging the ongoing confinement of Mr. Wimberly now that the 24-year statutory maximum sentence has expired. And it's important to recognize that he was not sentenced to one day to life, he was committed. And commitments are inherently indefinite in nature. All civil commitments are indefinite in nature. And that is part of the nature of a commitment. Now, secondly,
let me pause just a minute. The difference between sentence and commitment, I just wonder if that's not a red herring because the court clearly intended this to be a sentence. It was imposed as a sentence. It said the sentence is going to be, and then it checked that box, and then it said it's going to be a commitment. The whole commitment was vested under the management authority of the Bureau of Prisons, which can only be up to the sentence.
The Supreme Court has rejected that. In fact, they confronted an identical commitment, which at the time actually was described as a sentence in the prior version of the Colorado Sex Offenders Act. And they say, regardless of what you call this, regardless of whether this is a punishment for a criminal offense or not, this is an involuntary commitment and must be analyzed as such. And they cited Backstrom versus Harold. And that is a case in which somebody was sentenced to a crime. And then at the conclusion of a sentence, the state had him civilly committed according to different procedures. And the Supreme Court held this violates equal protection. There's no conceivable basis for distinguishing someone who has been completed a sentence from someone who is being civilly committed. And then in Humphrey, the Supreme Court extended that reasoning to an initial commitment like the one here, which was initially imposed in lieu of sentence and is limited in duration to the maximum permissible sentence. And now, Your Honor, I understand the use of the word sentence is confusing here, but under Specht, under Backstrom, and under Humphrey, it's crystal clear that this is not a sentence. Secondarily, the maximum sentence for the offense was 24 years, so he can't possibly be serving a sentence anymore because the maximum sentence is expired.
Counsel, the sentence was not limited to 23 years. The statute gave an alternative. It said, if you want to give a fixed term, it's 23 years. But there is another option under the sentencing authority itself, which is put them in a institution, and that could be up to life. So he never got a 23-year sentence. He never got a term that was limited by a term. So it seems to me that you're simply morphing what he got into what somebody else might have gotten.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I'm asking the federal constitutional question of what is treated as a commitment under federal constitutional law. And the Supreme Court is still clear that
isn't that a challenge to the original sentence?
No, because the characterization as a commitment is relevant both to our equal protection claim, which governs the lack of availability of process to him now. And I think it's important in this context.
Well, under the Supreme Court authority, he couldn't have challenged it prior to the mandatory expiring, could he?
That's correct, Your Honor. First, any of his confinement prior to the expiration of the 24-year sentence was valid. He wasn't able to bring a challenge before that. And
why couldn't he have said, I don't understand why he couldn't have challenged it immediately. Why couldn't he have said, this sentence is improper because it gives me the risk of being indefinitely held in jail. That provision in the Colorado statute is unconstitutional because it doesn't call for a new evaluation of my mental health at the time that the maximum sentence is expired. And so the sentence is wrong. It's unconstitutional.
Respectfully, Your Honor, those challenges were brought and they were rejected. The facial challenges were rejected on the ground that the people had not yet served the maximum sentence. That's People versus Kybell, in which is the Colorado Supreme Court said, look, maybe this would be unconstitutional if you overserved the maximum sentence, but you haven't. And in fact, at the time, most people only served 2 years. I believe in 1980, the Colorado Supreme Court noted that, in fact, the average confinement under the CSOA was 24 months. So the idea that this was ever intended to serve as a life sentence is really belied by the facts and by the fact that the Colorado Supreme Court expressly designated this as a commitment to be imposed in lieu of the sentence that could otherwise be imposed.
And let me interrupt you. Isn't it also true that because he's making an applied challenge, that he has to compare for his equal protection claim the way civil committees are treated at the time his sentence is going to extend beyond the maximum criminal? So the point in time that we have to look at for equal protection is after his criminal sentence has expired.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. So as the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court recognized it in the matter of Andrews, equal protection requires that any significant procedural rights granted to persons who have been involuntarily committed under civil commitment laws be extended to persons who are involuntarily committed under a sexually dangerous person law when the commitment extends beyond the limits of the maximum sentence. Likewise, in Grindle versus Miller, the New Hampshire Supreme Court held that once a defendant has reached the statutory maximum sentence, he must be released unless the state has him civilly committed. And then
let me interrupt again. Hypothetically, if when Mr. Wimberly finished the maximum sentence, civil committees were treated the same way. They didn't get judicial review either. It was parallel. You wouldn't have an equal protection claim. You still might have a procedural due process claim. But you wouldn't have an equal protection claim, right?
That's right, Your Honor. Then we would fall back on the due process clause. And it's clear in that context, contrary to what the district court said, freedom from bodily restraint has always been at the core of the liberty protected by the due process clause. And so a state can involuntarily commit somebody only if he has a mental illness that makes him dangerous. And once that's no longer true, the commitment must end. And so because of this important liberty interest, there are significant procedural protections that are required at a minimum. A person facing involuntary commitment must have an evidentiary hearing before an independent decision maker with the assistance of counsel. The findings have to be made by clear and convincing evidence. And because the commitment must end when its substantive basis is no longer available, those procedures have to be provided on a periodic basis. That is a claim that Mr. Wimberly could make, I think, regardless of, Judge Ebell's question about whether this is really a facial or as applied challenge. And in this case, Mr. Wimberly's commitment meets none of those substantive or procedural standards. There's been no finding that he's mentally ill or dangerous. He's had no right to an evidentiary hearing with the assistance of counsel on that question since 1984. So really whatever finding was made in 1984 can't possibly justify his commitment now, 37 years later. And the parole board review that the statute does provide doesn't even ask the right substantive question. Instead of asking whether he's mentally ill and dangerous, it only asks whether release is in his and the public best interest. And so for these reasons, Mr. Wimberly's decades-long commitment violates the Equal Protection Due Process Clauses. And again, Your Honors, I want to emphasize that whether this is a commitment or a sentence, it's not, it, under SPECT, it's clear. This is a commitment, and that's a federal constitutional question. You look to the findings and the procedure that's necessary to impose it, and that determines the nature of the confinement. And because this was not imposed automatically upon conviction, but as a result of additional findings made after additional process, it is a commitment. And when you look to the law of commitment, it is a commitment that violates both the Equal Protection and the Due Process Clauses. And for those reasons, we'd ask for the district court to be reversed. Thank you.
All right.
Judge Brett,
yeah.
Without taking more of her time, could I just ask her to give me the citation for a case that she referenced in her argument? No argument, just the citation. You mentioned U.S. v. Carvel, which you said held that he could not have brought this challenge until after the time for a fixed term had expired. Could you give me the cite to that case, please?
That was People versus Carvel at 701 Pacific 2nd, 37. It's a Colorado.
701 what? F second?
P second.
P second.
37.
35, so that's a Colorado Supreme Court case?
Yeah, 701 P second, 37.
And maybe I had read the case, but maybe I misheard the word then. Did you say Carvel? That's what I thought you said.
I pronounced it Kibel. You know, it's K-I-B-E-L.
Oh, K-I-B-E-L. Okay, I had spelled it C-A-R-V-E-L, and that wasn't the case I thought I was familiar with. Now, I understand. Thank you very much.
All right, Ms. Shane, I'm going to give you, you're out of time, but I'm going to give you a minute for rebuttal. But I do have a question for you, a hypothetical. Assume, you know, for the sake of my question, that the state statute had a bifurcated sentencing procedure, much like maybe would be the case in a federal court when someone is convicted as a recidivist or in a hypothetically in a death penalty jurisdiction. And here the court said, you know, for your crime, generally the maximum, and this is in the statute, that there are two potential penalties. There's a 24-year maximum, but on request or a motion from the state, you know, subject to a finding that the person is dangerous, that person could be subject to supervised release for the duration of his or her natural life. And if there is a finding that the person is dangerous, then the supervised release would take place through mental hospitalization. And in this case, you know, fast forward to Mr. Wimberly. Mr. Wimberly hypothetically is prosecuted under that statute. Would there still be a comparison between Mr. Wimberly and others who are it may be subject to civil commitment at the end of the 24-year period, or would we instead have to reject an equal protection or due process theory because he was simply got his process at the inception in 1984? He was either committed, whatever you call it, committed under spec, sentenced, whatever. He, under this statutory framework, was subjected to incarceration in a prison for 24 years, and then after that, through mental hospitalization, all as a consequence of the process that he or she received in 1984?
It's actually a pretty complicated answer, Your Honor. So first, if there was a statute which increased the statutory maximum sentence to include supervised release for a lifetime term based on a judge-made finding, that would present additional constitutional problems. It would likely violate Apprendi because any fact other than the fact of a prior conviction that increases a prior sentence has to be presented to a jury and found beyond a reasonable doubt. So, you know, from the outset, I think that's a problem with your statute. Now, I think what you're seeing, and it's also different because, so let's assume that instead of saying the statutory maximum sentence for this offense is 24 years, they had said the statutory maximum sentence for this offense is life imprisonment, which I think is actually what the current law says, right? And instead of saying that the statutory maximum is 24 years, they said it's life, but we'll parole you after 24 years. And so you could be paroled, but released to intensive supervision. Now that would avoid the Apprendi problem. You would get rid of the Sixth Amendment problem by increasing the statutory maximum sentence. And it would also avoid the equal protection due process problems here because the statutory maximum sentence would be life imprisonment. But that's not the situation we have here. Here, the statutory maximum sentence was 24 years. The state could have elected to choose a different statutory maximum sentence, but they didn't. And so because Mr. Apprendi was convicted of a crime with a statutory maximum sentence of 24 years, and because the state elected to commit him in lieu of sentencing, and this is really specific, this is what the Colorado statute says. It says in lieu of sentencing, instead of the statutory maximum sentence, they committed him. They are bound by the Supreme Court's precedent governing commitments, and those precedents make clear that once you reach the statutory maximum sentence, the conviction can no longer justify treating someone differently, and they have to be afforded the same procedures that are available to people who have been involuntarily committed under civil commitment statutes.
Can I push back on it a little bit? I don't know that you answered my question. And to say that respectfully, you're right. There is my hypothetical is laden with Apprendi. I think there's a potential Apprendi issue in our facts. Obviously, Apprendi is not one of the appellant arguments. So my question, I think, is under my hypothetical, is there still a potential equal protection violation or a due process issue? Because under my hypothetical, in 1984, that we know exactly what that person was going to get. He or she was going to get 24 years, and after that, they're going to a mental hospital. There's nothing like Humphrey, where there's a question about whether it would be automatically renewed, or in Backstrom, after the confinement, then the person is going to be subject to civil commitment. This commitment sentence, whatever it is all preset in 1984. So I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm just trying to get a handle on, under that hypothetical, is there still a due process or equal protection violation?
Your Honor, I don't think it presents the same due process and equal protection violations as this case, because in your hypothetical, the statutory maximum sentence includes lifetime supervision. Here, the statutory maximum sentence was only 24 years. And so under Humphrey and under Backstrom, his continued commitment beyond the 24-year period does violate equal protection due process. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate you indulging me. Well, Judge Rebell, did you have anything?
No, this was a very useful question, though, Judge Bacharach. I mean, a very useful answer both. So I'm really glad we took the extra time for that. Thank you.
Judge McHugh, did you have any quit interrogating Ms. Shin? Thank you. And we'll hear from the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Ann Stanton from the Colorado Attorney General's Office, appearing on behalf of respondent appellee Dean Williams. Mr. Wimberly pleaded guilty to and was convicted of first-degree sexual assault, a Class 2 felony. The trial court had two sentencing options at the time. It could either sentence him to a determinate term with a maximum of 24 years, or after additional fact-finding that he constituted a threat of bodily harm to the public, it could sentence him to an indeterminate term with a maximum of his natural life.
I'm going to stop you there and point you to the text of the statute itself, which doesn't fit your argument. It says that the court may, in lieu of sentence, commit the sex offender to an indeterminate term of 1 day and 1 year. That sounds to me like you have a sentence that has a statutory maximum, and then you have an option for commitment at the end of the sentence.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree for two reasons. One, the text of the statute does not refer to commitment in lieu of a sentence. It's commitment to an indeterminate term in lieu of the sentence otherwise provided at law. This is one sentence that's provided at law, and there's another sentence otherwise provided by at law. Second, the term commitment in the Colorado Sex Offenders Act is essentially synonymous with sentence. Many Colorado statutes use the word commit to refer to sending someone to a place to serve a criminal sentence. For example, Section 1722.5101 of the Colorado Revised Statutes governs parole eligibility date calculation, and it says, quote, when any inmate has been committed under several convictions with separate sentences, the department shall construe all sentences as one continuous sentence. Other sections with similar language include 1725101 and 171108, referring to commitment to the Department of Corrections or commitment.
Do any of those require, after you've had a jury determine that, or the person pleads guilty to the elements of the crime, that you then have a separate proceeding where you make additional factual findings as to the dangerousness of the person consistent with the finding needed for a civil commitment?
You know, the separate fact-finding...
Well, I answer it first. The answer is no, right? None of those involve that.
None of those statutes that I've named just now do not.
In Sprecht, the Supreme Court found that to be a pretty significant difference, right? They said you're having two proceedings. One is a criminal proceeding and the other is a mental health proceeding.
Your Honor, that's not quite right. In Sprecht, the first criminal proceeding was to determine whether the individual had committed a crime. That gave rise to a second criminal proceeding to determine what punishment to impose. Mr. Wimberly's reading of Sprecht is overbroad. It uses the term commitment, but it refers to the sentencing structure at issue here as a criminal proceeding resulting in a criminal punishment of an indeterminate sentence of one day to life. The language that Mr. Wimberly cites too about the proceeding, whether denominated civil or criminal, that holding simply meant that the fact-finding proceeding under the predecessor to the CSOA was subject to the 14th Amendment. That language has no bearing on whether it is a sentence versus some sort of civil commitment.
Well, if in fact it's part of the criminal sentence and you go from a maximum of 24 years to life, if you are dangerous, you find factual findings are dangerous, don't we run right into an Apprendi problem?
Your Honor, I believe that may be the case if this sentencing scheme had been in effect later on, but finding an Apprendi problem would require a finding that Apprendi applies retroactively to a 1968 statute that no longer applied to anyone being sentenced as a sex offender after 1998.
But when we're interpreting a statute, and we have two ways to interpret it, and one of them runs point blank into a constitutional problem and the other doesn't, shouldn't we take the one where we don't hit the constitutional wall?
Your Honor, there are other constitutional concerns here, however, another thing that Specht mentions is that the second fact-finding proceeding here is very similar to the habitual criminal sentencing statute. Under Section 18.1.3803, if a defendant convicted of a new crime allegedly has certain previous felony convictions, the court conducts a separate fact-finding proceeding to determine whether that defendant has in fact committed these other previous felonies, has these previous felony convictions. And upon that finding, the court sentences the defendant to a term that could be several times the length of what would otherwise be the sentence provided for at law for a felony of that level. It could include a life sentence at that point.
That's a prior conviction, right?
It's a determined, yes, Your Honor.
Which is carved out of Apprendi.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But there are other textual clues that this is intended to be a sentence and not a civil commitment or some other form of commitment. For example, the fact that people are sent to serve this time in the Colorado Department of Corrections, the trial court can only send somebody to the Department of Corrections upon sentencing under the CSOA. That indicates that this is a criminal sentence. Individuals under a civil commitment do not get sent to the Department of Corrections. Additionally, the fact that individuals sentenced under the CSOA are eligible for parole indicates that this is a criminal sentence and it was intended to be a criminal sentence. Additionally, it was imposed as criminal punishment for commission of a crime, as mentioned in SPECT, not as a form of treatment for a mental health condition. Additionally, the standard for the sentencing proceeding is making findings beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not by preponderance or clear and convincing evidence. These are all signs that the legislature intended to create a sentencing scheme here rather than an involuntary civil commitment.
Would you agree that if we read it differently and we say that we look at it and we say this is a commitment in lieu of sentence, would you agree that Mr. Wimberly has a valid claim under existing Supreme Court authority?
It's possible that you could come to that conclusion, Your Honor. However, there's nothing indicating that this would be a civil commitment rather than a criminal commitment, and there's no evidence of what sort of proceedings would apply to a criminal commitment that isn't a sentence. In fact, there isn't any sort of criminal commitment under Colorado law that applies to somebody who has been found guilty and convicted of a crime. The criminal commitment other than a sentence simply isn't something that exists under Colorado law. Additionally, the cases, the U.S. Supreme Court case law that Mr. Wimberly points to here describe sentencing statute or commitment statutes that are analytically distinct from the CSOA. The statutes in both Backstrom and Humphrey involve commitment schemes that were tied to the underlying, to a maximum term. The CSOA is not tied in any way to any sort of underlying maximum term because it is a separate criminal sentence with a maximum of Mr. Wimberly's natural life. The statute in Humphrey in particular is quite distinct from the statute at issue here. Among the distinctions are that the commitment statute at issue in Humphrey was intended to provide treatment for a mental health condition and not criminal punishment. It also allowed for the state to renew commitment proceedings on 5-year terms, which is not the case with the statute at issue here. It also,
I guess I'm not sure that the differences in the procedures in those other cases are really relevant. The important thing for the equal protection claim is to compare how Mr. Wimberly is treated, if this is a commitment, to how other involuntarily committed people are treated in Colorado. So it would be comparison of procedures in those two situations, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. But because this is a criminal sentence and not a civil commitment, that isn't applicable in this case.
Okay. If I disagree with you, though, you would agree with my analytical premise.
Yes, Your Honor.
Evaluate the equal protection claim.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand that. As I was saying about the statute in Humphrey, another distinction between that statute and the CSOA is that upon a finding of application of this commitment statute, the trial court in Humphrey would commit a defendant to the Department of Public Works rather than to the Department of Corrections, as is the case here.
Well, the court, they can do either here, right?
No, Your Honor.
It doesn't have to be the DOC. It also can, it gives them the opportunity to transfer them to the state mental hospital, correct?
Your Honor, the court cannot sentence anybody to the state hospital. There is a provision under the statute that would allow for the parole board to potentially transfer somebody depending on availability. However, that the fact that the parole board may be able to change somebody's status after they have been sentenced does not change the fact that it is a criminal sentence. The same way that the parole board granting somebody parole gives them a new status with a new liberty interest. We do not have
the
any...
The fact that the statute gives the parole board that authority suggests, at least to some people, that it's not a criminal sentence, that it's a commitment that follows the criminal sentence, and that's why the parole board can transfer him to the state mental hospital.
I understand that, Your Honor. However, there's no evidence that this has ever happened, either in this case or in any Colorado cases later than about 1980. The parole board has not, there's no evidence that the parole board has ever actually attempted to use this power and been successful in doing so. The fact that this statute may still be drafted this way without making a clear implication of whether this is a situation of the parole board being able to grant somebody parole upon the condition of commitment to the state hospital or otherwise does not convert this into a civil commitment rather than a criminal sentence. Your Honors, I'd also like to address Mr. Wimberly's due process arguments. Mr. Wimberly alleges that the parole process that he has received is insufficient here, and he requires a judicial hearing. Mr. Wimberly does not have a liberty interest in being granted parole. This is the statement that the district court was making about his not having a liberty interest in freedom from bodily restraint. Because Mr. Wimberly is serving a lawful criminal sentence, a lawful indeterminate sentence, he does not have a liberty interest in release from that sentence earlier than the maximum term, which is his natural life.
So again, everything turns on whether it's a commitment or a sentence, because if it's a commitment, then he does have a liberty interest, at least in being reevaluated periodically in a due process compliant procedure.
That is correct, Your Honor. But because ample evidence points to this being a criminal sentence and not a civil commitment, we don't even need to reach that analysis. I'd also like to address
Before you move on that point, and to follow up on Judge McHugh's question, even as a sentence, however, as I understand it, what you characterize as a sentence is that he was supposed to get consideration by the parole board every year from 1984 on. And as I recall, that he argues that he only received in whatever it is, 37 years, only I think 7 times was he given an opportunity to appear before the parole board. Even as a sentence, he would have been entitled to have state prison authorities to carry out the sentence as ordered, and wouldn't the unavailability of parole consideration for 30 of the 37 years constitute a due process violation?
Your Honor, that's not an accurate consideration of how often he has received parole. That's not quite the right picture. Mr. Wimberly received parole review 7 times, I believe, between 2010 and 2019. He did receive regular parole review as soon as he became eligible for parole. And
that was in 1984 when he was eligible for parole, right? Because
had he been sentenced only in this case with this one sentence, that would have been the case. Okay. However, because he had several other sentences that he was also serving, the manner in which these sentences were construed together gave him a later parole eligibility date. He did receive regular.
I thought these parole reviews were pretty perfunctory. I mean, in some cases they canceled them or suspended them. I don't know how often he ever, I think maybe only once ever actually appeared before the parole board. Is that right? I mean, weren't most of these pretty perfunctory? We're going to suspend it or we're going to defer it or something else?
No, Your Honor, these were not perfunctory reviews. Mr. Wimberly did appear before the parole board for an interview repeatedly. He is eligible for review for to apply for parole and be considered for parole on an annual basis. And that appears to have occurred in most cases that we have a record for. The parole board gives consideration to many different factors. Under statute, it is required to consider the actuarial risk of reoffense, victim statements, an individual's program and treatment participation, an individual's behavior in prison, whether the inmate has worked toward completion of education. These are the guidelines that exist under section 1722.5404.
Are you saying that at least seven times after he was eligible for parole, considering those other sentences that he had, that after that, at least seven times, he had the opportunity to appear and put on evidence whether he was still mentally dangerous?
Your Honor, it's not a full evidentiary hearing. He does appear for an interview before the parole board, and he is able to answer the parole board's questions and ask questions. The parole board also has ample evidence from his corrections record to consider to determine whether he is at risk of reoffense, whether he has
Does the evidence show that during those seven times that the parole board considered a psychological or psychiatric exam of him on a current basis about his mental condition?
We don't have a record of what precisely the parole board considered in these reviews. However, the question isn't whether he is mentally ill or remains mentally ill or has some sort of mental health condition. The primary question that the parole board considers is what his risk of reoffense is. There is an actuarial calculation that the parole board uses, a tool that has been provided. The parole board uses evidence-based measurements to make a determination whether somebody poses a risk of reoffense and whether it poses a danger to the public.
If they're just relying on an actuarial, which says the older you get, the less likely you are to reoffend, that ignores completely any analysis of his progress mentally. And it was because of a finding 30 or 40 years earlier that he did not have the capacity mentally to be safe in the public environment, that he was given that sentence in the first place.
Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree with that. There wasn't a finding of a mental abnormality specifically. It was after consideration of whatever evidence was presented, it was a finding of whether he would pose a threat of bodily harm to the public if at large.
But it was dangerous to himself or others. I thought that was the language in the statute.
That is the language under 2765.101. That's the involuntary civil commitment statute rather than the Colorado Sex Offenders Act, which does not include that language.
But the parole board does nothing different for someone who is serving this indeterminate sentence based on the separate conclusion than they do for anybody else up for parole. It's the exact same procedure.
Correct?
Yes or no?
Yes, Your Honor. And it is
a robust. They don't do anything that would be similar to what they would do if they're trying to decide if an involuntary commitment should be continued.
That's not quite correct. There are some similar considerations, including the risk of reoffense, the risk of harm to the public. The parole board considers many additional factors on top of that, including program or treatment participation and whether Mr. Wimberly or anyone else sentenced under the CSOA is actually progressing with treatment. The court considers victim impact statements and other whether there is a
victim impact statements from 34 years ago.
The victims are entitled to notice before a parole hearing and can write in and submit comments closer to the date. It's not simply relying on statements from 34, 37 years ago.
I take it our record does not contain evidence of exactly what took place at these parole review board reviews. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I do know that I'm out of time, but I also want to mention that to the extent Mr. Wimberly argues that he had skipped for any parole review that he was owed, he does have a remedy for that. He could file a petition for mandamus, for writ of mandamus in state court to demand that he receive the parole review that he is due. I do realize that I'm out of time, and I'm happy to address any other questions that the court has. And otherwise, I thank you for your time.
Judge McHugh, do you have any questions?
No, thank you.
Judge Abell?
No.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Stanton. And thank I you. Believe Ms. Shin has an additional minute for rebuttal.
All right, just as quickly as I can. First, just the original imposition of the commitment was based on psychiatric exams, and the finding was danger of bodily injury to the community. Second, the Supreme Court is the final word on what counts as a commitment for purposes of the Equal Protection Due Process Clauses. Under SPECT, this is clearly a commitment, and the state makes no effort to distinguish this commitment from the commitment in SPECT because it can. Third, the authority to transfer Mr. Wimberly to a mental hospital does show this is a commitment. That authority doesn't come with an ordinary criminal sentence. In Vitek versus Jones, the Supreme Court held that someone who's serving a sentence can't be transferred to a mental hospital without commitment procedures. And the fact that the state hasn't exercised this authority is irrelevant. The fact that the state treats Mr. Wimberly like he's serving a life sentence isn't exculpatory. The maximum sentence for his offense was 24 years, so the fact that they're treating him like he's serving a life sentence is the constitutional problem. And for that reason, we ask that the district court be reversed. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Judge Bell, do you have any additional questions?
Oh, so many, but no.
About this case.
Even about this case.
I was just joking.
No more.
Judge McHugh, do you?
No.
I also sound like a broken record. The briefs and the advocacy were absolutely, for both sides, were absolutely stellar. It's obviously a very difficult issues, and the reason we interrogated both of you so much and so long is because it was so extraordinarily helpful to all of us. So I, on behalf of our panel, we sincerely appreciate
It was partly for that reason and partly because you have been blessed today with a very conscientious and empathetic presiding judge who puts truth and discovery of the law above a few extra minutes between us and lunch.
Thank you, Judge. This matter will be submitted.